In a picturesque church of a small village in Somerset, we find ourselves once more amongst those criss-cross paths of the Great War. Here we find memorials to famous names. But what does it tell us about the wider memorialisation of a generation who fell in the trenches of the First World War? While European travel has returned now, the Great War battlefields along the Western Front still feel a little bit far away because there still are some barriers to travel. But this month, October, it should be changing. And I'll be off at the end of this month on my very first battlefield tour since 2019 with Ledger Holidays. And I hope to record something from that for the podcast while I'm out there. But this week, we're looking once again at a subject that we've discussed a few times on the podcast, and that's the First World War at home. The Great War, the crisscross paths of the Great War, don't just take us to those battlefields from more than a century ago. Whenever we go out in our own communities and wherever we travel within this country, we come across aspects of the Great War, whether that's war memorials in the towns and cities and the villages, or whether it's memorials to individuals who served and died and sacrificed their all in that conflict. The Great War really is everywhere. It's all around us, and we encounter it in so many different ways. So with that, with World War One at home in this episode, I travelled last week down to St Andrew's Church at Mells in Somerset with my old friend John Hayes Fisher. John's a TV producer who I've had the pleasure of working with on many occasions over the last 20 years on documentaries about the Great War. But for both of us, while working within history is our job, we've both had a lifelong fascination with the subject of the Great War. So while we were on a trip down to Wiltshire, we did a slight diversion across the border into Somerset to the village of Mells, to St Andrew's Church. This is a church with a 15th century tower with some later additions right up to the Victorian period. And it sits in this sleepy village of Mells, typical of many of the villages in that area of Somerset. And in the approach to it, down a little narrow street to the gate, it's almost as if time has stood still there. And when you see the church in the surroundings of its churchyard, it is very much a typical English church, the sort of thing we'd expect to see in guidebooks or a coffee table book depicting images of the English countryside. But it's a lot more than that. For those of us interested in the Great War, there is a wider fascination when we visit places like these. When we come here and we can see graves in the churchyard, and amongst them the old Commonwealth War Graves Commission headstone. But it's not just that, we know that on some of the family graves there might be names, so immediately you begin to think, what will I find here? What will I discover about the Great War in a place like this, both outside the church, in its churchyard, and within it? And it's here in places like this that the Great War doesn't seem very far away. The echoes of those battlefields, they seem all around us. So what will we find here? What will we find at Mells? We're still a long way from the Western Front at the moment. Although things are changing and travel is returning, I've yet to make that journey across to the old front line. So this week, I've come to Mells in Somerset, a small Somerset village, where in the church are memorials to some significant characters of the Great War. And I'm just walking into the church now through the church gates that are here. It's a quiet corner of Somerset, but it holds so much Great War history. And now I'm in the churchyard, which we'll come back to, but we're first, the birds above me, first we're going to go into the church. I'm standing in the entranceway to Mel's church now, and it's something like 30 years ago since I last came here with my old friend Maurice Johnson. And when I lived in Reading, me and Maurice used to come out and explore places like this, and he brought and showed me so many treasures across this landscape over the years. And I'm going to go in the church now, because in many respects, for those of us interested in the Great War, this is one huge memorial site. So I'm just opening the door and heading on in. And I'm really grateful to the church wardens here who allowed me to make this recording. And we're inside the church now. And the first thing you see from a Great War perspective here is a memorial to the glory of God and in loving memory of Staines Geoffrey Bates, Captain, 7th Hussars, Adjutant, North Somerset Yeomanry, only son of Gilbert Thompson Bates, tenant of Mells Park, born 2nd of June 1884, killed in action at Hoog near Ypres, 13th of May 1915. Fight the good fight of faith, lay hold on eternal life, whereunto thou art also called. And on there are the badges of the Hussars and the North Somerset Yeomanry. And the Yeomanry was connected to quite a few of the people from Mells in one way and another. And the cavalry connection here, which will become apparent as we go into the church. But churches are places of worship, but they're also receptacles of our history. Wherever we go, the history of this nation is found in these little time capsules that are churches, and it makes them both a place that you come to think and contemplate on your own life, but also on the past, and the ghosts of the past walk with us here in many respects. And I'm walking now into a corner of the church where there's this fabulous equestrian statue of Edward Horner. Edward Horner had also served in the Yeomanry, and then he ended up in the Royal Horse Guards, and then latterly, I think it was the 18th Hussars, and served with them on the Western Front. And Bates was killed in the Second Battle of Ypres in May 1915, when the cavalry, dismounted, was serving as ground troops, as infantry on the battlefield, and Horner was there too, with the Hussars, and he was badly wounded in that engagement, which took him off the front line for a good year or so. And then he returned and was put in charge of a cavalry troop and was wounded in the Battle of Cambrai in November 1917, that first great use of tanks, not the first use of tanks, but the first mass use of tanks in the Great War. And there was that strange battle in some respects of the most cutting-edge technology going into action, the tanks, the Mark IV tanks, the new tanks, part of the newly formed tank corps. And then alongside it, cantering into action, were men from cavalry brigades, such as Edward Horner, on horseback. So the old and the new way of warfare was fighting there side by side. He was wounded, evacuated to a casualty clearing station where he died of his wounds, and he's buried in Requigny Equincourt Road Cemetery on those Hindenburg Line battlefields. And this is a fabulous bronze statue of him on horseback. And one of the people that has a heavy hand in this church in terms of memorials is Edwin Lutyens. Lutyens knew the Horner family, and if the name Horner is familiar, some of you may remember the old nursery rhyme Little Jack Horner. It's said that they're distant descendants of that, but who knows whether that's true or not. But Lutyens knew the Horner family, who lived next door in the big house. And he was commissioned to make a number of the memorials that are in here connected to Horner and some of the others, and also the Village War Memorial, which we'll go and have a look at afterwards.
But this beautiful bronze of Horner atop his horse, it's a great symbol of that part of the Great War, that move from the 19th century approach with cavalry to the new total war of the 20th century. And his story kind of fits into that. And behind him is a memorial to those from the village who died. And we see Bates, whose memorial plaque that we saw on the way in, listed there. We see Edward Horner. But at the top of the list is Raymond Asquith. And Raymond Asquith was the son of the Prime Minister, H.H. Asquith, who was in many respects a broken man after the death of Raymond on the Somme in September of 1916 with the Guards. And they too had a connection to Mells. And all of these men are tied together. There was a group of very wealthy aristocratic families called the Soles, and their children were the children of the Soles. The Coterie was their nickname. And they were a group of very wealthy, in many respects entitled, young people who liked to party hard. It included Edward Horner, Julian Grenfell, Billy Grenfell, Raymond Asquith. He was said to be one of the more steady influences on the group. Lady Diana Manners was another one. Duff Cooper. All these people that the war suddenly crept up on them in that golden age of Edwardian Britain, when money and privilege took you a very, very long way in every aspect of your life. And the Great War crept up on them, and the Great War wiped out the Coterie. Edward Horner at Cambrai, Raymond Asquith on the Somme, Billy Grenfell and Julian Grenfell in the Second Battle of Ypres in May of 1915. And Lady Diana Manners, who was so close to so many young men of that generation, just lost one after another. A few weeks before, she lost Raymond Asquith on the Somme. Basil Hallam Radford, the great music hall star of that generation, who was a balloon officer, died on the Somme, and she was very close to him. So that upper class of the period of the Great War, because these were the type of men who went into the army to become officers, to lead from the very front, they were amongst the first to fall. And the proportional casualties amongst that kind of generation from that sort of background were much, much higher. And of course, with money, the families of those men having money, they had the ability in places like this to memorialise them. So we see this magnificent memorial here to Edward Horner, but it doesn't stop there. There's more, and we're going to go and explore that now. So I'm just walking to the back of the church now to look at another memorial that's here connected to the Great War. We've driven from Kent across the downs of Wiltshire and into Somerset to come here through rain and then sunshine across the downs, a landscape, a chalk landscape, so familiar to those of us who walk the Somme and reminiscent of the Somme, close to where the film 1917 was filmed a few years ago. And the sun has come out now, and it's lighting this church, this beautiful church, with this incredible wooden roof and this open landscape, and the sound in here as well echoes, like I was saying, that these churches are not just places of worship, they're receptacles of history. And the way that our voice resonates through this, once the voice of the Asquiths and the Horners resonated here too. So it feels as if that kind of history is not that far away. And on the wall here, there's another touch of Lutyens. There's a bronze wreath that was made by Lutyens for this memorial to Raymond Asquith, where the typeface was designed and carved by Eric Gill. And Lutyens' hand here on these memorials, and these memorials to Asquith are very much part of the story here, and they link us to his journey to the battlefields and his death on the Somme in 1916. And it doesn't just end with this. This is just a set of simple words on a wall with a bronze wreath above it. But we've got something that connects us to the very spot where his war ended, which we'll see shortly. I'm walking now up into the far corner of Mel's church and up into a little area where there's a big stained glass window, a beautiful stained glass window that is to the memory of John Francis Fortescue Horner, who is Edward Horner's father, who worshipped in this church until his death in 1927. And the memorial window was designed by William Nicholson, who was well known as a painter and illustrator and printmaker. But it's not this that we've come to see, although that connects us back to Edward Horner. It's just above the next doorway, up on the wall there. I'm looking at the wooden cross, the original wooden cross that stood on the grave of Lieutenant Raymond Asquith. And this is a Celtic cross with his name on a wooden disc in the middle. Lieutenant Raymond Asquith, 3rd Battalion, Grenadier Guards, in loving memory of, and then died of wounds, 15th of September 1916, in the fighting around Guillemont and Ginchy on the Somme as the Guards Division made its first attack there. That's where Raymond Asquith fell. And recently I picked up a collection of photographs taken by someone who served in a Graves Registration Unit in the Imperial War Graves Commission just after the war, a series of photographs depicting the battlefields as they were in that aftermath period, which I'm going to return with a podcast to the subject of those illustrations in November. But one of them, and of course part of his task was to photograph the crosses on graves to be sent to family members at home who'd requested them. But he took his own photographs as well, and one of them is a picture of Raymond Asquith's cross on that grave at Guillemont. So I'm standing here now, I have it on my phone, a picture of this cross in its original place on the Somme, and here it is now in front of me, hanging here on the wall of St Andrew's Church in Mells in Somerset. And this little bit of wood takes us across the channel to another area of chalk downland in northern France, those rolling downlands of the Somme, and connects us to that part of the battlefields of the Great War. And that's why coming to places like this is just so interesting and also so important in the way that all of this is interconnected. We don't just visit the battlefields. We don't just see the things that we see along that old front line. We come to places like this and we see the echoes of those battlefields and the stories of the men and women who died there and how it connects us to those places. And it's difficult really to describe the feeling of standing here thinking, having stood at Raymond Asquith's grave, Asquith, who knows what he would have gone on to do. Churchill said of him that he lacked nothing except length of years. And on his grave, and it's an inscription replicated on Horner's, this great star of England. You know, this was the future of England in the eyes of the coterie, in the eyes of the souls, in the eyes of these great families. Over centuries, these people had been very much part of England's story. And they thought they would be forevermore. But the Great War changed all of that, destroyed the aristocracy, and brought these great lineages in many cases to an end. Asquith had a brother who served in the Royal Naval Division who survived the war, lost his leg. But many families ended on those battlefields. The lineage came to an end, and we visit National Trust houses as we do. One of the reasons there are so many houses within their care is because those families were destroyed by the Great War, and there was no one to take on those great estates and those great houses. So when we come to a place like this and see that simple wooden cross on a wall, it makes us reflect on so many different things. But the story of visiting this church is not over. This is what we've come to see inside. And I'm just going to go back via Edward Horner's memorial now. But out in the churchyard, we've got something to see there as well. And we'll go and see that shortly. But we're just going to head now back to Edward Horner. Walking back to Edward Horner's memorial, I'm kind of drawn to it because it's so impressive, such a stunning memorial. And sitting atop a cenotaph, and it's the cenotaph designed by Lutyens, and the bronze statue of Edward Horner is by the sculptor Sir Alfred Munnings. And it brings together that two types of memorial material that we so associate with the Great War, the Portland stone of structures like the cenotaph in London and so many war memorials across Great Britain, and the bronze that we see often of bronze Tommies, figures of sailors and soldiers and families that are depicted in bronze on memorials again across this country. And so much of the commemoration of this generation was done through those two materials, the cold touch of Portland, white Portland stone, and the dark bronze, the contrast between perhaps the old world of light and the dark world of the Western Front and the trenches of the Great War. Perhaps I'm over-reading that a bit, but standing here, and this week, not sitting in my podcast studio at home, but being on location, I think it does make you pause and ponder over these things. And it's nice to be back here after so long, and the sun has come through the beautiful stained glass windows in this church, and it's cast light across the memorial panel behind with the names on there. There's no rank, no status against these names, although there are what you would describe as great men like Asquith and Horner on there. There are ordinary people too who paid just as much a price for their sacrifice in the Great War. And it's quite nice that the memorial reflects that, that there they are, equal in death. But now we'll say goodbye to Asquith and Horner in here, and we'll head out into the churchyard. So I've come back outside now. We're going to head round into the churchyard outside St Andrews, because there is another great character of the First World War, not just commemorated here, but buried here. A man who survived the war in this case. And we're going to go and see his grave. I've come out into the churchyard here at Mells, and it's a sunny afternoon now, and the wind is gradually passing through the leaves of the trees around me in their early autumnal state. Crows up on the church above me, and I haven't heard a chiff-chaff yet, but we're kind of outside the season for them really in many respects anyway, but I can hear some finches in the background there. No skylark above us, but it's not the bird song that I've come to see or hear here. It's to visit a particular grave that I'm sitting in front of now, and it's not a war grave, but is the grave of someone very much connected to the Great War, Siegfried Sassoon, the poet. And Sassoon is buried here. He was born in Kent in 1886 and died in 1967. He converted to Catholicism late in life, and Knox, the priest that converted him, is buried here, and Sassoon, it was his dying wish that he be buried as close as possible to him, and Knox's grave is only a few behind me, a couple of rows behind me here, so it is very close. So Sassoon, really by a quirk of fate and circumstance and life, unconnected to the Great War, is here in this place where this church has so many of its own connections to that war. And Siegfried Sassoon, of course, is one of the great voices of that conflict, one of the great anti-war voices of that conflict. Sassoon's most famous poems is the one about the general. "Good morning, good morning," the general said as we passed him last week on our way to the line. Now the soldiers he smiled at are most of them dead, and were cursing his staff for incompetent swine. "He's a cheery old card," grunted Harry to Jack, as they slogged up to Arras with rifle and pack. But he did for them both by his plan of attack. And that's typical, I think, of the bitterness that you see in a lot of Sassoon's poetry. One of the ones that I particularly like is Blighters. It's a strange poem, really, about a tank in a music hall. "Tier beyond tier, they grin and cackle at the show, while prancing ranks of harlots shrill the chorus, drunk with din. We're sure the Kaiser loves our dear old tanks. I'd like to see a tank come down the stalls, lurching to ragtime tunes or Home Sweet Home, and there'd be no more jokes in music halls to mock the riddled corpses round Bapaume. And that last line about mocking the riddled corpses round Bapaume is very much at the heart of a lot of Sassoon's war poetry. That remembrance of the dead, that nod to the sacrifice and what the faces of those ghosts that he'd lost, his men, the officers who served alongside him, and his friends, including fellow war poet Wilfred Owen, how that stayed with him for the rest of his life. Sassoon was one of the survivors of the Great War. There's no grave in Flanders or France. It's here at Mells, in jolly old England. And Sassoon stands here, where so many of his friends never made it back. And I think doing this podcast, although Sassoon's poetry is really not favoured by many of those who would like to move away from the "Oh, what a lovely war" school of thought and study of the Great War, and that's a good and the right thing to do, to see the war in the round and understand that not every general sent Harry and Jack up to Arras with no chance of survival. Sassoon, as I say, there's a bitterness in it. I mean, he described the Menin Gate as a sepulchre of crime, for example. And what he meant by that was that they died in hell, Passchendaele, and a whole generation had disappeared in the mud, as he felt. But Sassoon's work, when you read it, there's a great connection to the landscape. He spent a lot of time on the Somme in the quiet period in late 1915 on into early 1916 before the battle began, and he witnessed the opening stage of the battle, that sunlit picture of hell, he called it. But that connection to the landscape that he knew, having grown up in the Weald of Kent, on the Kent-Sussex border, that appreciation of landscape, I think, stayed with him and comes across in what he writes. And when I read his words, it's one of the ways that I think we can connect to the battlefields that so many of us have not been able to visit in the past year or so. And I just want to read a couple of his poems for you now, and this one, again, about landscape and looking ahead, I suppose, beyond the Great War. This is called 200 Years After. Trudging by Corby Ridge one winter's night, unless old hearsay memories tricked his sight, along the pallid edge of the quiet sky, he watched a nosing lorry grinding on, and straggling files of men. When these were gone, a double limber and six mules went by, hauling the rations up through ruts and mud, to trench lines digged 200 years ago. Then darkness hid them with a rainy scud, and soon he saw the village lights below. But when he told his tale, an old man said that he'd seen soldiers pass along that hill. Poor silent things they were, the English dead, who came to fight in France and got their fill. And so many, I think, survivors like him questioned that sacrifice. The common phrase was, "an all for what?" And I think it shows a common experience of servicemen. There must be men now who've served in recent wars who might look back and say the same thing. And Sassoon, and so many of his contemporaries who did survive like him, lived in that shadow of the Great War, looking back on those that had lost and asked why and for what gain. But this one, this poem in particular, has resonated with me in this last year or so, and I think you'll see why. You may not be big fans of poetry, but hopefully this might mean something. It's called Sick Leave. When I'm asleep, dreaming and lulled and warm, they come, the homeless ones, the noiseless dead, while the dim charging breakers of the storm bellow and drone and rumble overhead. Out of the gloom they gather about my bed. They whisper to my heart, their thoughts are mine. Why are you here with all your watches ended? From Ypres to Frise, we sought you in the line. In bitter safety, I awake unfriended. And while the dawn begins with slashing rain, I think of the battalion in the mud. When are you going out to them again? Are they still not your brothers through our blood? And that being haunted, in his case, by the men that he left behind, the men who were still serving, he wrote that during the war, I think more than a century later for us, when are you going out to them again, is a question that we've asked ourselves in this past 18 months. When will we return to those battlefields? When will we get back to the old front line?
A visit to Siegfried Sassoon's grave was once more quite powerful. He is undoubtedly one of the greatest voices of the First World War, rightly or wrongly. And the average person in the street, if they've heard of anybody from that period that has written about the subject of the First World War, Sassoon is likely a name that they will know. But when we're standing in that churchyard and looking around at what is that typical English churchyard with the typical sort of graves that we expect to see in a place like that, it's not just Sassoon that where we find echoes of the Great War, it's in the graves surrounding it. And as I explored that area of the cemetery with my friend John, we discovered quite a few connections to Asquith and to Horner, because really that part of the cemetery is very much part of the Asquith and Horner family story. And we find here graves connected to the souls and the children of the souls, the coterie. Now, the subject of the coterie, of that generation of quite privileged young men and women who before the Great War were in that small group, that small social group, where they lived life to a degree, to excess. But the Great War, as I mentioned in the podcast, crept up on them, and very few of them lived to see the other side of that conflict. That's a subject, the story of those men and women, that I intend to return to in a separate podcast devoted to them, because it's so rich with the stories and the connections. But it's worthwhile, before we leave Mel's, mentioning a few more of the connections that you find here. There's quite a few graves as we were walking in this part of the cemetery that really caught my eye, and one of them was Catherine Asquith. She was the wife of Raymond Asquith, killed on the Somme, a daughter of Sir John Horner and a sister of Edward Horner. So Edward Horner and Raymond Asquith were related by marriage. Asquith married Edward Horner's sister. And when you think that Edward and Raymond's parents knew each other because of this, and you know, as we again mentioned in the podcast, that on the grave of Edward Horner and Raymond Asquith in France, at Requigny and at Guillemont respectively, on that headstone is the same inscription. That inscription, small time, but in that small, most greatly lived, this star of England. And the repetition of that quote on both graves cannot be any kind of accident. This is something that they must have sat down and thought about and done deliberately. And it shows, really, that in that period of loss after the Great War, as families came to try and come to terms with the loss, this networking of parents to think about how they would commemorate those who'd fallen, and the network of wives and sisters and brothers, was all part of how that generation was memorialised. And it's a fascinating subject in its own right. Catherine Asquith, whose grave is here at Mel's, had served herself in the Great War. She had volunteered as part of the Voluntary Aid Detachment as a VAD and had served overseas. So that terrible, awful blow, receiving the news of the death of Raymond Asquith, her husband, came while she, too, was serving. They had married in 1907 and they had three children, including Julian Asquith, who became the second Earl of Oxford and Asquith. And he had a son who he named Raymond in memory of his own father, Raymond was born in 1952, and he's now the third Earl of Oxford and Asquith. So while I was visiting Mills, it was quite nice to think that there is a Raymond Asquith alive now who perpetuates that name in memory of that man, that great star of England, who fell on the Somme. Not far from Catherine Asquith's grave, we find the grave of Lady Violet Bonham Carter. She was Raymond Asquith's sister and born in 1887, so she was nearly a decade younger than Raymond. So here, as we walk around this churchyard, there are these incredible connections between all these families and all these characters from the Great War. She knew Rupert Brooke, for example, so the connections just go on and on. And she went to see him off when he sailed for Gallipoli in 1915, a voyage that he would not return from. He was bitten by a mosquito and died of blood poisoning in the Aegean Sea en route to Gallipoli, never serving in the campaign. But he became one, like Sassoon, one of those great voices of the First World War through his poetry. Poetry very different to the bitter poetry, as we discussed, of Sassoon himself. Violet Asquith married Sir John Morris Bonham Carter in November of 1915, and her youngest son was named Raymond Bonham Carter, again in memory of Raymond Asquith, who had died on the Somme. So these families didn't just memorialise them with physical monuments that they built. When they had children, they named them after the fallen, and that continues down the lineage to this day. And Raymond Bonham Carter, named after his uncle had fallen on the Somme, went on to have his own family, and one of his children is Helena Bonham Carter, the famous actress. So it's just connection after connection after connection in a place like this. Lady Violet Bonham Carter continued in the family tradition of liberal politics after the Great War, and she was very, very outspoken in that period of appeasement, against speaking out against appeasement, speaking out against the government's policy at that time as another war loomed. And you must wonder sometimes at what that generation who'd seen members of their own family fall in the Great War to end all wars, the Great War for civilization, how they must have felt in that period when, with the rise of National Socialism and the arrival of Adolf Hitler and the extreme politics of the right, how it must have felt to see another conflict looming so close. So as part of our journey around Great Britain, when we look at the First World War at home like this, whether it be here at Mells or in our local cemeteries and on our local war memorials, we're now at this period a century from when the war memorials were built right across Britain. The first ones were made during the war. There were street memorials in places like Hull. And then from 1919 onwards, you begin to see this pick up apace as community after community after community begins to put together war memorial committees to commemorate the dead. And by that period of 1921-22, that's when the plans made in that immediate post-war period were put into practice and the monuments were built. So while the centenary of the Great War itself has now passed, we're in a different centenary, really, the centenary from the aftermath of the Great War, whether that be the reconstruction on the battlefields or the construction of cemeteries and memorials on the sites where the battles had taken place, but also, and not forgetting that, as we discussed here, the building and the planning and the execution of memorials right across Great Britain. And I mentioned in the podcast that we'd end at the War Memorial in Mells, and we did go down to look at that. It was another piece of memorialisation designed by Lutyens. He designed the memorial that sits there that commemorates not just Asquith, not just Horner, but the whole of the fallen from the village of Mells. And it sits on a little road junction within the village, just down from the church. It has a main inscription, which is quite an unusual one, which I'll read for you now. "We died in a strange land, facing the dark cloud of war, and this stone is raised to us in the home of our delight." And that kind of sums it all up, really. Here are the words cut into stone, memorialising that generation who had marched off to fight for places just like Mells. And that's what many memorials try to express. This was a generation that had sacrificed itself for king and country in a bigger sense, but in a much smaller one, in the heart of where they'd come from. It was for that place that they'd marched to war, for the families that they'd grown up amongst and the people that they knew. And coming to places like Mel's, discovering all this history, discovering once again those crisscross paths of the Great War, this is what inspires us to find out more, and when we return, will no doubt lead us into new journeys along the old front line. Last month we had the very first social evening for those of you who support the podcast via Patreon and Buy Me a Coffee. It was a very successful evening. It was good to see people there, and there was lots of interesting questions and debate. And we've got another one of those evenings coming up very shortly, where we're going to have a couple of guest speakers. And this is a good way to say thanks to those of you who support the podcast in this way. And I just wanted to mention it, as I've always said, that the podcast will always be free at the point of use. You'll never have to pay for it to listen to it on the usual podcast platforms. But very many of you from the very beginning were very keen to support it in some way. And by supporting it, it does enable me to take the podcast further and develop it in all sorts of different ways. So this week's episode, recorded in Mills, was done with a proper recorder that I was able to purchase thanks to those of you who support it via those two platforms. And going forward, I'm using podcast support to get some filming equipment to go out to the battlefields and film, once we can return there properly, and film locations to create some video content to give a slightly different dimension to the podcasts that we can't do through the traditional route. So this is something that you listen to via your phone, via your smartwatch, via whatever process it is that you listen to this podcast, but there's no visuals. So to have some visuals available on YouTube and elsewhere, then that gives you an opportunity to see some of the things that we're talking about. So how does it work as a podcast supporter? Well, there's two ways of doing it. Patreon is one of them, and with Patreon you pledge an amount per month, and that then helps to support the podcast on a regular basis and enables me to plan and budget as we move the podcast ahead and we expand its horizons into the different things that we plan to do. Currently, the two tiers for Patreon are £4 a month or £6 a month. And once you've signed up for it, it's not like joining the French Foreign Legion, you're there for life. You can cancel it at any time. And some people have supported the podcast like this for a few months and others since the very beginning. And both of those things are absolutely fine. And I'm really grateful for the support that you've shown. And it means if your circumstances change or you get fed up listening to the podcast, you can cancel it at any time. And you're not tied into something that you can't get out of. So it's a safe and secure and flexible way for you to support the podcast as long as you want to. The other way of supporting it is via Buy Me a Coffee. And this is a one-off payment that you make. So you come along and you can buy one or more coffees just to say thanks for a particular episode or for a group of episodes, whatever you like. And there's no regular commitment to it. You can do it once. You can do it more than once. It's entirely up to you. So two different ways of supporting the podcast, which hopefully means that support is flexible for all. Now, what are the benefits of supporting the podcast? Well, firstly, I like to think that many of you see it as a positive thing in supporting a content creator like me, in enabling me to put this information and this history and these stories and everything else connected with it out there, and for which I'm obviously very thankful for your support in that. But you also get access to our, what I describe as our growing community of the old front line, of bringing together a group of people with a common interest in the Great War and visiting the battlefields and having regular sessions where we meet up online. And beyond that, not just online, I hope that we'll get a chance to meet up on the battlefields as well, whether that's for a battlefield walk or a battlefield tour. Who knows? As we emerge from the dreadful year and a half that we've all had, there's lots of possibilities for this. So supporting it means you in help ensure that the podcast continues. You become a part of the Old Frontline community, and we have these regular meetup events. And like I say, we've got another one of these social evenings coming up soon. And once I get to the point where I begin to create video content, you as supporters will get to see that before the general public, before it's put onto the public channel of the Old Frontline on YouTube, for example. So there are benefits in being a supporter, but it is not, and I want to stress this, something that you are obliged to do as a listener. You help support the podcast just by listening to it, just by downloading it and listening to it. And the figures get better and better every month, and I can't thank you enough for all of you who listen to this podcast. But I just wanted to explain how this process of Patreon and Buy Me a Coffee support worked, because many of you have asked recently. So hopefully that explains it, and hopefully I'll see some of you at the next social evening, which I'll put the links up for that very soon if I haven't already by the time this podcast goes out. But as we move towards that period where we all begin to return to the battlefields over this winter, then I hope that I'll see some of you out there. And as always, I'm open to any ideas people have got for the future of the Old Frontline podcast. So, thanks to you all, and I'll see you next week. You've been listening to an episode of The Old Frontline with me, military historian Paul Reed. You can follow me on Twitter at SomCorps. You can follow the podcast at Old Frontline Pod. Check out the website at oldfrontline.co.uk, where you'll find lots of podcast extras and photographs and links to books that are mentioned in the podcast. And if you feel like supporting us, you can go to our Patreon page, patreon.com/oldfrontline, or support us on Buy Me a Coffee at buymeacoffee.com/oldfrontline. Links to all of these are on our website. Thanks for listening, and we'll see you again soon.